Okay. Anyway, I just, I guess just to start, I need somebody in the driver's seat.
Just tap the
Right. Let me just show you what
this is. This is the way you want them?
Well, however you would like the lights. I don't know how the lights
so work
out
first
better.
One.
Yeah. Okay, so this is red, red, and if you have to go back, I think this is like, is this back? Yeah, this is back.
Okay. Oh, so just use those. Okay.
You could just use these, or you could this is red. Hi. So glad you can make it.
Okay.
Huh?
It took me a little long to get here, but, you know, better late than never. Okay, anyway, so we were talking up until now, I guess if I wanted to just say what was happening with the Jewish people at the time, the honeymoon is over, okay? When they settled, you know, it was very hard settling the land, settling in Eretz Yisrael, and they had a rough start. But soon after they settled, Alexander the Great came coming through the scene, and the Greeks basically took over the world, the Middle East as well. He took over Egypt, and for 10, 11 years, Alexander was alive, just battle after battle. After he died, it was 20 years till the four generals, five or four, however you work it out, they all decided how they divided up the world, and the Jews were divided between, it was sandwiched between what we would call the Northern and the Southern Empire. The Northern Empire was by a general Seleucid, so that became the Seleucid dynasty, and the Southern Empire was by a king by the name of Talmai, and that was known as the Talmai Empire. And for the first 100 years or so, the Jews were under the Southern Empire. The Southern Empire basically was, you pay us our money, you give us our taxes, and you're okay. We'll leave you alone. And that's basically what happened. The front of the Southern Empire was north of Israel. So Israel was within the Southern Empire. In the year 200 before the Common Era, which is about 100 years, 120 years after Alexander passed away, 100 years after the split of the Greek Empire, the Northern Empire started their expansion. They started, and they took over the land. The Northern Front started moving down, and it started with a person by the name of Antiochus III. Now, Antiochus III, he's not our Antiochus. He's the father of the Antiochus III. And he came down, and basically he conquered Eretz Yisrael, and when he conquered Eretz Yisrael, so Eretz Yisrael then moved from belonging to the Southern Empire to the Northern Empire. The Southern Empire and the Northern Empire had different ways of ruling their vassal states, the countries that they conquered. The Southern Empire was more like, you know, you can do what you want, just, you know, show your loyalty and just pay your taxes and everything is fine. Very little intervention. Southern Empire was also very into the educational part of it. And the Southern Empire was into the knowledge and learning. They had a library, and they're the ones that translated the Torah. And then when we came into the Northern Empire, so that already, they did things a little differently. There was more like our way or the highway. Or that's it, you know, and they wanted things. Now, what was even more important was that since the Jews, for 100 years, they identified themselves with the Southern Empire, and that was not good for the Northern Empire. The Northern Empire is going to want the Eretz Yisrael to be part of their empire. In any case, in 175 before the Common Era, so now Antiochus IV dies, okay, and his son Antiochus III dies, and Antiochus IV takes over. Now Antiochus IV was he was a little bit more than, you know, more ambitious than his father. And Antiochus IV is now going to have more designs on the Southern Empire. First thing he does, or not first thing, one of the things he does, you can go to the next slide. So internally, what he does is he's met by a person by the name of Jason, and this Jason happens to have been a Hellenized Jew. And Jason comes and we'll speak a little bit more about Jason, but one of the things he wanted to be Kohen Gadol. And he bought his position, he bribed Antiochus IV, and Antiochus appointed him as the new Kohen Gadol. Of course, now there's an agenda here. And the agenda is just to try to get the Jews more Hellenized and more part of the major culture, major empire at large. And we're going to see what he does. In 173, he makes a visit to Jerusalem. And after 3 years, now Jason's doing a lot. You know, he makes a gymnasium, we'll see, does all these things. But after 3 years, I guess Jason is not moving fast enough for that Hellenized... Huh? I guess you could... If anybody wants a copy of what's here. So, after 3 years, they didn't have enough with... Jason was not doing enough. And there's a person by the name of Melanus. Now, Melanus was the tax collector, but he was a go-between. Jason actually sent Melanus to go talk to Antiochus. And Melanus was a very conniving, underhanded type of a person. And basically, Melanus said, if you appoint me as Kohen Gadol, I'll get you a lot more money. So, first of all, Melanus was not a Kohen. He was from the tribe of Benjamin, but that didn't seemingly stop the appointment. And where did he get his money from? None other place than the Beis HaMikdash. Now, also just keeping back in the mind, because as the story is going to unfold now, in 198, before the Common Era, this is all during Antiochus III, okay, before Antiochus IV came in, Antiochus III had a battle, had a war with Rome, and lost. So the one thing you don't want to do is when you have a battle with Rome, you don't want to lose. So part of the treaty with Rome was the treaty of, Apame Treaty. And basically, the treaty was quite a number of things that the Greeks had to give up. One of the things that they had to give up is they had to have somebody from the royal household to be educated in Rome. And if they show you disloyalty, then you're taken care of. As a matter of fact, Antiochus IV was one of those people. He was in fact educated in Rome, but he came back afterwards. So he was one, and then somebody else, Demetrius, who we'll see later, was taken in again from the royal household. The second thing is another thing was is that Rome really had a lot to say in what the Greeks had were going to do. The Greeks had to give up their navy. The Greeks had to and anything that they were going to do in terms of wars and everything really had to be first okayed with Rome. Comes along Antiochus IV, and now we're coming to the story of Hanukkah, and you could turn once. Just mentions again about Jason, and turns just what I said before. Turns Yerushalayim into a makes a gymnasium, tries to Hellenize. Melanius comes in afterwards, replaces Jason as Kohen Gadol, even though he's not a Kohen. But the next one, just a little bit about Jason on the next one. For 3 years, pro-Hellenist policies, practices pagan games, and actually in Maccabees, it just says that the Jews started going to the games instead of the Beis HaMikdash. He leaves after 3 years. The next slide, Melanius comes in, replaces him, even more Hellenistic than Jason. He's a Benjamite. He's from the tribe of Binyamin. Now, Jason replaced a Kohen by the name of Chonya. Chonya was a good Kohen. He was the legitimate Kohen. And when Melanus took over, so I guess it could be Chonya made a protest. Something just depends on who you're protesting, but that's something that Melanus didn't like so well, and he had Chonya killed. Now, what happened is, I'm just going to go to the next slide. So now this is where everything is going to start to happen, and everything is going to start to happen quickly. There was the new king of the southern empire was Talmai the Eighth. Okay, I'm sorry, Talmai the Sixth. Talmai the Sixth was the new emperor, new king of the southern empire. And he was too young, he didn't have experience, he was not such a good king. He actually caused a fight against the Northern Empire. Antiochus the Fourth, I'm just going to say Antiochus now, Antiochus didn't like it, started a war back. And Talmai did not have control of his armies. In any case, Antiochus won, and he won big. And he actually went ahead and in 170 to 168, it was a war. He actually made his way into Egypt and he took over the place. By doing this, he built himself a navy, which was against the treaty that he had with Rome, and he took over Egypt. And he won. He's going to be, they were all related, because somewhere his sister or daughter was married to this Talmai's father. So they basically were somewhat related, but Antiochus came and he says, "Look, I'm going to take care of this boy. I'm going to be his new. I'm the new regent, and I'm taking over this Talmai. This Talmai, and I'm here, and I'm going to take over everything, and I'm in charge now." Now, what this really did is this got Rome very nervous, because Rome was using Alexandria as a base for their operations. And Rome needed bases all across the middle, all over the world they really needed. They had very, very good supply lines, and that's how they would supply their armies, and they had bases all over. Eventually they're going to get a base in Eretz Yisrael. It's going to start with Yehuda Maccabi, so they were very nervous. And basically they gave Antiochus an ultimatum, and they basically said, pull out. Now, of course, Antiochus was not very happy with that, but he was afraid to start with Rome. So he started to pull out. And he was retreating back. Not retreating, but walking out of Egypt, and he's going to leave Egypt the way it is. When he was walking out, so I guess they don't have like internet the way they do now, and the way media and how everything, there was a lot of misinformation. Jason, again, now who was Jason? Jason was the Kohen Gadol, right, that was originally appointed by Antiochus, who then got rid of him after 3 years and appointed Melanius. So Jason said, Antiochus lost. Antiochus is leaving. It must be he lost the war. It must be he's weak. It must be now's my chance. Now's my time. So Jason started a rebellion in Yerushalayim, got himself an army, and started a rebellion to try to get back to become Kohen Gadol for himself. In the process, it was a war in Yerushalayim, a battle, skirmishes. It depends who you ask, but it depends who you read, but there are hundreds, if not thousands, of Jews were killed in this little skirmish. Jason, Melanus runs away. Jason now is the new Kohen Gadol, and all of a sudden, Antiochus, who's coming back, right, in order to get back to Syria from Egypt, you have to go through Israel to go back, and all of a sudden he hears that Jason has started, took back the Kohen Gadol. Now, Antiochus took this, I guess, personally or whatever. He understood this as a rebellion against him. So he wasn't very happy with this. So when he came, and also you have to realize Antiochus, his pride was hurt. He lost the war, and he's like, you know, here he is. He won the war, but now he's being forced to retreat. So he comes back, and this is in 168, he comes back, and he comes into Yerushalayim, and he causes a bloodbath. He goes ahead and he kills Jason, and he comes into the Yerushalayim, reinstates Melanus, and now that's it. He says, no more Mr. Nice Guy. We need all you. We need the new front to be here. Again, he lost Egypt. He couldn't take Egypt, but he doesn't want to lose Eretz Yisrael. That buffer, he wants that. He wants Israel to be the new front with the and very strong and very comfortable front that he's part of his empire. So that now we're ready, and you can. I don't know where I'm at. Antiochus attempts. Okay, so. One more, keep going in. Okay, now what he does is he comes into Yerushalayim, and one of the things he does is there's something called, which we know later, which was rebuilt up by Herod, called Antonio's Fortress. Antonio's Fortress is a fortress, a major fortress, right next to the Temple Mount. So this is what Herod pictures. Do we really know what it looks like? But this is a the model of what the Antonio's Fortress looked like. This over here is the temple courtyard. So this fortress was overlooking the temple courtyard. It was rebuilt by Herod and made as big as it was then, as you see it here. But even before, it was a fortress. And what Antiochus did is he took his forces and he put his forces, his men, in that fortress. And if you have that fortress, you have Yerushalayim, you have the Temple Mount, and you have everything else as well. The Syrian or the Seleucid forces are going to be there for the next 20 and 30 years. Yehuda Maccabee is not going to get rid of those forces. He's going to be able to besiege them, but there's going to be back and forth. It's not going to be for another 20 years or so until Shimon, the last of the Hashmonaim, is going to finally siege them and starve them out. Yeah.
Has any of this been excavated?
Sure. You can, if you go there now, there's a certain place. I've been on it. I've been there. It's when you go towards the Damascus Gate. At some point, you'll see like a little alleyway with a big green door, and they take you through the green door, and you can actually. They say that's built on. That area is built over the fortress. I mean, it's been destroyed, and it's like one of the. There's a window there that you could see over on the Temple Mount. We know where it is. It's and actually there's a sign there in Greek saying that up until here could non-Jews go. It's like because it was a way to get onto the Temple Mount from there. But that was a fortress then, and this is going to be like they're going to have control of this area. So he has control of the area. And now he starts with his regular persecutions. He goes for the religious aspect of things. He wants them all to join, have pagan worship, introduces pagan worship into the temple, drunken parties, Zeus offers pigs on the altar, and all this while Menelaus. I don't know. Again, I don't know if I'm saying the words right. And he joins in. He's part of the activities. Okay. And this is what's happening now. And this is the story of Hanukkah. They come in and they take over the set. Antiochus took over the base of Megdash, and he's forcing all the Jews. In the next slide. Okay, good. Antiochus forbids the practice. We know what he did. He took all Sifrei Torah. He starts to burn. No Shabbos, no festivals, no circumcision, and I guess we all know the story of Hanukkah, right? This is sets up sacrifices with pigs, forces everybody to eat, and I guess we know all the main stories. Any questions on the stories of Hanukkah? But this is all familiar with us. I don't think we have to go into this particulars. He has friends, the Samaritans, who have always been our enemies or nemesis, and in the area, they give him his full support. Fine. Now, just in the next one, you should know one of the biggest differences from until now, especially during the, you could probably say for the since maybe Mitzrayim, is the first time that there's religious persecution. The Jews were never persecuted religiously up until this time. Other cultures were available for them, during the Shoftim period, during the Malachim period, there was Avodah Zarah, but there was never an outside force forcing the Jews to worship idols. I guess thinking now, maybe you could say there were some kings that were of the Jewish kings that, you know, were pushing idols, idol worship, etc. But this is the first time an outside force came in and said, your religion, we want you to abandon your religion and take over our religion. I guess also the second thing is from here, this is also the first time you come into martyrdom, which is, dying al Kiddush Hashem. It's also for the purpose of religion. Really, before this time, it really was not a very common thing. Nobody would say, give up your religion or I'll kill you. It just wasn't part of the history. So this is a very big, new stage or new event for the Jewish people that came up. I guess that's an interesting question. I mean, we know in the Gemara, a person has to give up their lives for three things, right? For the big three, you know, Avodah Zarah, Shvichas Damim, and Gilui Arayos. If a person says, I want you to either bow down to an idol or do a Avodah Zarah, I'll kill you, you have to allow yourself to be killed. Murder somebody else or I'll kill you, you have to allow yourself to be killed. And Gilui Arayos, which is anything immoral, you have to allow yourself to be killed. There are other categories. If, let's say, it's Chil Hashem Barabim in front of a whole group of people, then you may also have to allow yourself to be killed. If it's at a time of Shmad, at a time of persecution like this was, you probably, even for less things, would have to allow yourself to be killed. You know, they said, eat pig. But if normally a person, a guy, puts a gun to a Jew's head and says, eat this cheeseburger or I'll kill you, then the person does not have to allow himself to be killed. You know, a person says, you machal Shabbos or I'll kill you, doesn't have to allow himself to be killed. But here, so I guess the Rabbanim of the time, and we're talking, this is the Gemara time, this is in the time of the Tanayim, and more specifically the time of the Zugos, the pairs. So this, you know, they had their Rabbanim then, and I guess, you know, there was who to ask and what the Pesachim were. As you can see over here in the picture, so the Hellenists or the Greeks only had a very minority part of the Jews. Most of the Jews were not Hellenists. Most of the Jews were probably in the middle. And some of them were the Hasidim, or the, however you're going to call them, the extremists, right-wing ultra-orthodox fanatics, as the New York Times calls us. But there was a few that were, you know, that were extreme against Greeks. There were a few that were for the Greeks, but the bulk were in the middle. They weren't, you know, they weren't looking for trouble. They wouldn't fight the Greeks, but they wouldn't, you know, they're not going to go against it. They were there in the middle. So then what they decided to do is they started to branch out. I guess the Greeks went to different cities, little moshavim, yishuvim, and whatever they had, whatever they called in those times. And you can go on to the next slide. And they put a little altar in the little town of Modi'in, and they said, that's it, we put up a little thing, and they wanted everybody there to bow down. You can go to the next slide. Where's Modi'in? Modi'in is pretty much where Modi'in is today. It's a very big town. It's like one of the fastest growing places. It's a beautifully beautiful location. Next to Modi'in is another little town called Hashmona'im. There's Kiryat Sefer nearby. It's a really, really beautiful place. So the emissary came, and they came. They put an altar in the middle, and they sacrificed a pig. And they wanted somebody to come and sacrifice and eat a pig. And it just so happened to have been, that was the town of Matisyahu. Matisyahu had his five sons, And basically they killed, there was a Jew that said he'll do it, and Mataziel killed the Jew, and then he killed the officers that came, and if you kill Greek officers, that's tantamount to making a rebellion. If you want to turn to the next slide. So, did I miss something? Is there like a picture? I guess. Oh, we'll turn back one. Go back one. Nope. I don't know why it's not in here. And maybe it's a little later. Okay, so the Mataziel, we all know, had five sons. Eliezer, I think he was the oldest, Yochanan, Yehuda, Yonasan, and Shimon. The rebellion is in 167 before the Common Era. Again, in 168, Antiochus came back from his campaign in Egypt, reinstalled Melanus, started all these decrees. Within about a year, they started going outside Jerusalem to all the people in the little small towns. After this incident, Mataziel and all his sons, they ran to the forests, they ran to the caves, and they had a little rebellion. We all know this is five sons. Eliezer, oldest one, Yochanan, Yehuda. Now, Mataziel dies on his deathbed, okay, shortly after this rebellion. He is one of the few, very few of the Hashmonaim to die naturally. The five sons of Mataziel are going to die very, very, some of them very cruel deaths, or they're going to die in war. Maybe, I think, Shimon's son, Yochanan Hyrcanus, and maybe Alexander Janus, or Yanai as we know him, those two. Yochanan Kohen Gadol, Yanai, and Yanai, I think maybe those two are going to, you know, die on the deathbed, but the brothers that come afterwards and the pretty much everybody's going to die and die in a terrible way. I don't know if I mentioned it last time, but there's a Ramban in Vayechi in last week's parsha, in the on the pasuk when Yaakov gives his brachos in the Brachos Yaakov. So Yaakov says in his brachas to Shevet Yehuda, into Yehuda, he says, Layasur Shevet Me Yehuda. The scepter should not leave from Yehuda. And over there, the Ramban brings down, you know, many things, what that means. And there he actually points out, he says, the Chashmonaim, that were tremendous tzaddikim. And without the Chashmonaim, Torah would have been lost in Klal Yisrael. But why did they suffer such terrible deaths? Is because at some point they should have removed themselves from being the king, from the royalty. When Shimon came about, he became Kohen Gadol, and the line continued in the Chashmonaim until all the Chashmonaim were wiped out. And they should have given up the throne, and they didn't. And the Ramban in Vayechi on that pasuk points out. He says that was the punishment for the Chashmonaim. Hashmonaim had three sons. Before he died, he said Yehuda should be the. Go further. Yehuda Hamakabi is going to be the one who is going to lead, and he is going to. We're going to see a little bit about his genius. Now, I did some research about. You know, here we are. We talk about the story of Hanukkah, right? The story of Hanukkah. We were outnumbered, and we were. You know, and all of a sudden Yehuda came with, and it was a tremendous military victory, and it really was. But I was doing just a little bit of a background on what were the Jews up against. So you can continue. Okay, this is something called the phalanx. I guess again, I'm hoping I'm saying it correctly. The phalanx was the beginning of this is the core of the Greek army. And basically what it was is it was about 16 by 16 square of people. Each of them had these big sticks, these big swords. There's a name for it, I don't remember, something in Greek with an S. But it's about, these spears were 22 feet long. So they had a spear in one hand, they had a shield in the other hand, and they were very tightly packed. And when they were on offense, when they're charging, they were a little less packed. But when they're on defense, it was tightly packed. The first five rows of soldiers had their spears down, and the next they had it up. So if like to block arrows or things coming in above them, And this was a call of phalanx. This is the core of it, and you can go on. There's another picture of it. This is another picture of it. Keep going, one more. And this is really what it looked like. Now, the phalanx was set. It was like you would have four of them. Made up another name of a. It was called a. I'm not sure of the name, but it was they four of them made up a different type of a division. So they had like 1,000, 256 times four. They had 1,000, and then they had different groups. 1, 2, 3, 4. Now you could set up the way they would normally set up was the width of a football field. So you figure out like you know, and you had the front line filled out with these people. You see how long, how far it went. This is what you got to get through, right? This is what you're up against. And this is just the phalanx part. This is just the foot shell, the infantry part. You can go just a little further. Now, I don't know how to say the word, but the hypaspists. So this was like an elite group of the phalanx. These were people, they were a little light, more lightly armed, they were lightweight, they were more experienced, and they were more, they would also be like, they were more mobile, and they would be able to do more things. And we'll see where they were. They were usually on, let's say, the sides of the phalanxes. So you had the big things, and now how do you stop them from coming from the sides? So you had these groups, and sometimes they would be used to fill in the regular phalanxes. And let's keep going. Now, besides phalanxes, they had elephants. Now, these elephants are not exactly accurate because the elephants that were used by Lysias were actually, they had a big wooden box and it held an Indian rider and four Greeks. So from all directions they were able to shoot and do things. By the way, okay, there you go, a little bit more pictures to say a lot. Now, these elephants, by the way, they weren't used in the first three or four battles. This is going to only be used, I guess, the fourth battle. And this battle, it was against the treaty, the Treaty of Apamea that was used with Rome. So one of the things that Rome, when they had their war with Carthage, and Carthage and Rome were using elephants, they decided that, you know, just like in World War I, they decided, let's not use gas, you know, and that's there was like a understanding of the whole world not to use gas. So it was an understanding in those days not to use elephants. They broke the treaty. The Greeks were that desperate at that, we'll see, that they decided, we don't care about Rome, we care about, you know, subduing the Jews. And you see what happened in that war. They were somewhat successful with the elephants. Let's keep going further. Besides elephants, now that besides all of this, they have cavalry. Cavalry is horses, men different. They're light cavalry and heavy cavalry. Depends on how much armor they have and what goes with them. Keep going. These are different. This is what they're. Okay. These are the companions. More about this. Eight squadrons, different nobles. It's called the Sarissa. That's these big swords. The 12-foot Sarissas, heavily armored. Okay. Oh, one or two more. Okay, another picture of horses and more pictures of horses. Okay, different ways that they would. Okay, keep going. Okay. So now, this is just the people. Okay, so you have the big, the phalanxes, you have the higher level phalanxes, you have cavalry, you have elephants, and these are the weapons that they had, the modern weapons of the day, and they were the, what do we have? We have swords, javelins, spears, bows, slings, ballistas, I'm not sure what they are, battering rams. Okay, and now the last one, this one, okay.
So that's the stone-throwing thing.
Right, okay. Okay, those are the ballistas. Okay, so you have a lot of, they have anything at their disposal. Now, this was like a, this was a lineup. This is how they would set things up if they had the chance. And here are your phalanxes. Here are your hepacists. These are the high level ones that would help out here, fill in the gaps, and also be the difference between here are your companions and your cavalry, light cavalry. Cavalry on the other side, and this is where the other team would line up on the other side. It looked like a football game, I guess, you know, the front line against the front line, and they would just, you know, go at each other, and you got to get to the quarterback on both sides, and let's see whoever wins. So I was reading up on this, you know, because this is, you know, you think it's just a simple game, you know, you push forward and they push forward and what happens, but like Alexander the Great, when he wanted to get to Daryavish, right, they had a lineup like this. One had a lineup and the other had a lineup. So how did Alexander was a brilliant strategist. What he did is he kept this, the what we have, the left part of the line, he kept it strong. So they were battling it out each other. This, the right part of the line, he had them retreat slowly. So the Persians thought that the Greeks were retreating, so they kept pushing down and pushing down. What that did is that opened up for his cavalry and made a beeline right for Daryavish. Brilliant how he, you know, I guess, you know, if you know what you're doing, and Daryavish, he flew, he retreated, you know, he made a retreat for that, and but that's, you know, how they would, if you know what you're doing and how you use your cavalry and how you use your phalanxes. Okay. This is what, now we're going to talk about the Jewish army. Jewish army, this is what we have. We have a small band of farmers. They're farmers. They're not warriors, farmers. Armed with farm implements and homemade weapons. I could see them coming with the rakes and the forks and the, you know, shovels coming out. I mean, we're laughing, but this is really what they had. I mean, you know, a few armed, you know, a few... no military training, and I guess there were several hundred men. Now, for the first year, okay, again, in 67, 66 was the, I guess, one second, we'll go from here. Okay, so for the first few months, they were in the woods, in the caves, and they were just doing small-time raids. He built his army up to about 600 men that were with him. People wanted to stay away because, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. 600 men, well, you know, that's just causing for trouble. But he did. He had a support, a base among all the Jews. Yehuda, knowing all this, so now how is he going to deal with the Greeks? So he had a few. He was brilliant. First of all, he was very flexible. I guess you can turn to the now battle. Fine, that's it. So first of all, he had a few things that worked with him. First of all, is the intelligence. He had very, very good intelligence. He was tracking the Greek armies, and he knew exactly what they were doing. And he saw them going a certain way. He knew which path they were taking. He had scouts and from other people, and he knew how many they had and everything. Okay. The next thing is. He dictated the field and style of battle. He never got into an open battle like the Greeks were used to. Okay? And the one or two times that he did, he lost. Okay? We'll see what he did. You know, he also was very flexible. He changed on a dime. He realized that he had to move things around and move things differently. Also, element of surprise. You know, when you're going with a phalanx, there's no surprise. You just go, you march, you get there, you set up, you know, and that's it. There's no surprise. There's nothing you can do surprise. And he's going to learn after his first battle how to kill if you kill your commander early on and they're in a situation that they're not used to, so then you own them. I just want to point out the very interesting, I was also reading up on in the Six-Day War. So there were two types of tank battles. There was one in the Sinai, and there was one for Yerushalayim, in Samaria, whatever, to get back to Yerushalayim. So the battle in Samaria, the tanks, they went by the book. It was like through the book. Tank battles 101. They followed all the, and that worked for them. When they got to the Sinai, it was happening pretty much 2 days early, but they were very flexible. They didn't follow anything in the book, and both ways were successful for the Jews then. All right, the first thing is Apollonius is going to come in with his battle. He's coming in. He comes in with 2,000 against 600 Jews, and this is the first battle that's going to happen. He waits for them to come into a ravine, into a very narrow path. Apollonius' armies are traveling 4 across. Okay, so he has 2,000 people, 4 across. He waits for them to come to a path that's narrow on both sides, that has things coming in on both sides, and he waits for them to get in. And his strategy was as follows. He caused a distraction in front. He had a little force in the back, 150 each, and then on the sides. So basically what he did is he first surprised the attack in the beginning. Apollonius was traveling in the middle of both phalanxes. So he had 2,000, 1,000 in the front, 1,000 in the back, Apollonius is in the middle. And they were unready for this. Yehuda Maccabee comes, he attacks in the front. And he's attacking straight down. The front is starting to get decimated because, first of all, they're not set up. They're very heavily weighed down with their heavy gear and armor. They're not ready to move. And, you know, the people behind them, they don't even know what's going on, and they keep coming in. You know, they keep coming in, and they keep getting killed. By the time there's a commotion, and there's a blockage and everything, and the Jews then started hitting them on both sides. And on one of the sides, he had one of the fronts. So now they're facing forward. They gotta deal with the front mostly on one side, a little bit on the other side. When Apollonius came forward to see what was going on, he got hit, killed right away. Then Yehuda also had it. He waited for them all to come in, and he blocked off the rear. So the people started running away. They couldn't run away. This battle was a wipeout. He just killed all 2,000. And after that, he had weapons. He says that Apollonius' sword, Yehuda Maccabee had for the rest of the time. That was the first thing, and he got for himself a name. This was the first battle that was. And now all of a sudden, oh, now we got a problem. We got a rebellion. And by this time, we're ready. You got 600 men who with Yehuda, with a victory. Now he started getting more volunteers. The next battle was then he sent in, Antiochus sent in a general by the name of Saron. And Saron, he did not want to make the same mistake as the first one because he didn't want to come in the ravine. What they're basically going to keep doing is they're going to be coming down south. See, Apollonius came through the mountains. And that was bad because you can't set up your phalanxes. You need a wide open plain. So Saron was smarter. He says, I'm not going to come down the mountains. I'm going to go more of the coast, which was not in the Jewish hands. Came down the coast, and he came across a little more south, which was about by Sechara, and this, I think, is around where Latron is. Latron is the...
Highway 443.
Okay, there we go. You know where it is now.
The
Fortress Latron, right. This is a major battles in the War of Independence in 48.
This Bechoron is up 443.
Oh, so I'm not... The next one is Latron.
Latron is on one.
Okay, so the next battle is going to be Latron. This is a little bit north of that, but he cuts down a little further south. And basically troops. So it's not 2,000, it's double the amount of troops. Yehuda Maccabee, he gets about, he now has 1,000. He doubles his, but it's still now you're still fighting about 4-1 odds. He does the same thing. He waits for them to get to a certain point. Now this time, he couldn't seal off the end, because if he would wait to seal off the end, he'd lose the element of surprise. So he does the same thing. He waits for them to come to a certain point. He attacks them at a certain point. And the same thing applies. This was also the same type of a battle. He hits them up in the front and then from the side. So he did lose the end, the last 1,000 or 2,000 were able to run away. But he made a decimation. He killed Saron. And he once again was very victorious. And now, all of a sudden, now Antiochus starts to get really, really upset. He says, all right, that's it. No more Mr. Nice Guy. So now he sends Lysias. Now, at this point, something else happens. Antiochus is not only is he having problems in Palestine, I don't know what they called it, Israel at the time, but he's also having he's having trouble in the east, and he also needs money. So what do you do when you need money? You go ahead and you raid other countries, other temples, and you get money. So he was going to go east. He was planning this attack on the east. Now, Antiochus is going to end up dying in the east, but we don't know that yet. But now he realizes he can't just send a little token force to Eretz Yisrael to put down the rebellion. He has to send a much more greater force. So he sends Lysias. Lysias becomes the regent of Antiochus V, his son, and he says, at all costs, get rid of them, finish them off. So he gets himself three generals, Talmi, Nicanor, and Gorgias. Now, it says in two different places. In one place it says that they came down with 40,000 infantry, 7,000 cavalry. Other places it says it was only 20,000 infantry. But in any case, you're close to 30,000 people. At that time, I think Yehuda, maybe he had like about 10,000. But again, you got to get through 30,000 of these people. So now this is now what happened. I'm sorry, he had only like 6,000. So the odds here, you're talking 30,000, they're 5-1. 5-1 against a very superior army, warriors, etc. This is what they're up against. Now what happens is, let's go to the next one. This is going to be a battle of Emmaus. Emmaus, I don't know, Emmaus, I don't know how to pronounce it. But now these generals are smarter. They're not going to make they're not going by Beis Horon, but they're going even further south. This is, I think, about near where Latron is. This is they're coming across south in order, again, to get close to Yerushalayim. Their plan was get into Yerushalayim, meet up with the fort that's in Yerushalayim. It was called Acre, the Acre fort. Meet up with them, and then from Yerushalayim that is the base, and go out and squash the rebellion. But they got to get to Yerushalayim. So they come out to Emmaus. Now, Yehuda Maccabee, this really shows Yehuda's greatness. So basically what happens they encamp at Emmaus. Okay? Now, Yehuda is camped further to the south. Gorgias knows this, and Gorgias goes ahead, and at night, you see, normally the Greeks don't do any war at night, but they decided, we're going to surprise Yehuda at night. And they sent 6,000 troops under Gargis at night to go against Yehuda. Yehuda knew this. He had the intelligence for this. So what he did is brilliant. What he did is he removed everybody from the camp. And this is going, again, south, except for 200 people. He put a lot of fires up in the camp so they'll think that there's a lot of people there. And basically what happened is in Gorgias, during the night, when they started to come to the camp, they found it empty. But the 200 people of Yehuda's army kept retreating south. I'm sure they were throwing things or whatever. But their job was to take that force and to have them chase nothing. And they really did. They chased it. So now, out of the 27,000, okay, we got rid of 6,000 less. Okay. You still got 21,000. Yehuda decided he took his main force. He took a force of he took a force of 1,500. He divided his forces into four battalions, and he had them go north around on top behind the camp of the camp of Emmaus where the Greeks were stationed. Then he took the last 4,000 to head them to meet them straight on. Now, the problem was, to meet him straight on, he was hoping by dawn they'd all be sleeping and they wouldn't be ready. But he was wrong. It was the first time he had to meet up with the phalanx. The Greeks were prepared for his force, but instead of hitting him straight on, he came from the side. And I guess they were very successful at getting at the side. And they got through he had one of his army fighting with the light cavalry, and one of them going right past the cavalry, going right, hitting through the phalanxes on the side. Okay? So, you know, the phalanxes, again, they're not good at hand-to-hand combat. They have these big javelins and, you know, and big heavy armor. You have a very big, good advantage if you can get into them. And that's what Yehuda was doing. Meanwhile, there's no communications. You don't have cell phones, right? So what about the 1,500 that's on the other side? So they really thought that the Yehuda Maccabee was wiping up. They thought there was all a surprise, but in fact it wasn't. Yehuda Maccabee with the 3,000 there, they were having a hard time. This was real, real combat. The rest of the camp, there's about 10,000 strong in the camp, plus, besides in the camp, they were so sure that they were going to wipe out Yehuda Maccabee that they actually brought in with them into the camp slave traders. And all these other people, they came into the camp and they were starting bargaining already how much are going to slaves be, because they figured 6,000 people, we're going to have thousands of slaves. You know, it's going to be a... And everybody, and they brought people in with, you know, they had all their gold and their slave traders and everything besides, you know, the main army. They had a lot of people there. They were not ready for the 1,500 coming from the north. And they came into that camp. There were 10,000. And they just started going ahead and killing. And it was, they were being very successful. Meanwhile, Yehuda was battling on the front, you know, of the line that they did set up. They're having a hard time, but from the north, they're coming in, wiping out the place. And it was a panic because slave traders, they're not here for war. So they started running. And when they started running, the people from the camp started running. And all of a sudden, the people who were battling Yehuda, all of a sudden started looking back. And they started realizing the camp is under attack. Meanwhile, they're fighting. So they started running. And it was a rout. It was an unbelievable rout. And they started running. Now, Yehuda Maccabee could have done one of two things. He could have chased them, but he did not. The reason why he didn't chase them, why? Because he still had a force of 6,000 chasing, you know, chasing Yerushalayim. He still had to worry about them. So he enforced his discipline. He says, nobody touch anything. If anything, they started burning up the camp. So all of a sudden, this is dawn already. And afterwards, you know, these 200 people are still drawing, you know, the 6,000 out. And all of a sudden, they look back and they see their own base camp up in flames. And then they started, you know, running to the coast. And they started giving up. Instead of chasing the 200, realizing that they were drawn out, they started running back, and Yehuda started attacking them, whatever he can get out of them. And that was it. That was a tremendous destruction. That was a tremendous victory for Yehuda Maccabee. Then Lysias said, all right, now really no more Mr. Nice Guy. Okay, he wasn't done. And you got to realize, we're not talking about years. We're talking about months over here. This battle took place in 65. And now we're going to go to, now what happened is, in this, after 65, one second, you're going to have one more battle coming up. And that is, Zias is going to go ahead and he's going to send, I'm sorry, after this battle was the, hold on one second. Okay, there's going to be one more battle after Emes, and that's the battle of Beis Tzur. Okay, actually it's not a clear picture, but okay, This is the highway to Yerushalayim. Maybe you can help me out over here. This is basically where the battle was. Here's Lutron. So there's Hashmonaim Fortress, and this is where it took place. And, here's Lutron, and this is where Emes. This is where the battle was. So that's the battle. There's going to be one more battle, and this time they're not going to play any games. So what he does is he sends in again another army. About the same as the last army. 20,000 infantry, 4,000 cavalry, but this time Yehuda is up to 10,000. And they're not making any more mistakes. They go down the coast, all the way past to Hebron. So they're not coming across to Yerushalayim. And in south of Yerushalayim, around Hebron, that was the Idumeans, which were hostile to the Jews, and they were favored, and they were coming up from the pass in the south. And this was also a another battle that he had to battle with. This is a just getting confused with one of two battles. But he stopped this battle as well. He routed them. And after he routed them, now he comes into the Beis HaMikdash. I'm sorry, I said December 25th. It should be Kislev the 25th. I don't know, maybe it's also December 25th, I don't know. But
different,
It said, and he came in at 164. Now, mind you, there was still a fortress of Acre, which had the Greek, the Seleucid army was there. He would try to get them out. He couldn't, but at least he contained them. He got into the Beis HaMikdash, and he cleaned out the Beis HaMikdash, and that was the story of Hanukkah. Okay? Now, while this is happening, Antiochus IV, he ends up dying, and he was succeeded by Antiochus V. This is basically, now we're basically up to the story of Hanukkah. Yehuda at this point knows that he has a I guess he has a little bit of time, because he realizes, you know, there's things going on in Syria, and we're going to see what happens. We're going to see what happens after Antiochus dies, and but basically that's how now we're, this is the story of Hanukkah. They come in and they rededicate it, and the Pach Shemen lasts for 8 days. Now, you could just say what they win, but outstanding inspirational military and inspirational leaders. He was a great, he was inspiring the men tremendously, because he had to get, you know, they had to fight. The odds were against them always. It was his military genius, and you could maybe say, but, you know, they used his tactics as what we would call, what is called as guerrilla warfare. You know, when you think of guerrilla warfare, sometimes you think of, you know, attacking civilians, attacking, you know, doing underhanded things, but that's not, the guerrilla warfare there was just not letting them set up their phalanx and doing their you know, guerrilla warfare means taking them out on a different battle scene. Just want to just go to one more thing. Keep going. Victory, struggle continues, religious freedom, and we're going to keep going one more. Okay. Now, one of the things that if you realize when we speak about Hanukkah, it's almost like the Gemara for sure downplays the military victory. And what do they, we focus on the miracle of the 8 days. And one of the things really you could come to that is that, you know, if you study Yehuda's, you know, strategy and everything, you may come and begin to say, you know, maybe it wasn't such a miracle. You know, you take a look at his, how he had the intelligence, and he was fighting the homeland, and he had, the people were more, you know, inspired by him than, as opposed to mercenaries, and they had more to lose. And he had, he knew the terrain, and he was more flexible, and they were not, they didn't learn the lessons. They, you know, they kept the cavalry coming again and again. The cavalry for them is worthless in these mountains. What are you bringing horses for? You bring, you know, whatever. But they didn't learn their lessons. So you may want to say, hey, no, all right, you know, not such a miracle. But that's why Chazal point, that's one of the reasons why HaKadosh Baruch Hu made a miracle on the oil to show, just like this was a miracle for Heresia, all the wars were a miracle for Heresia. No matter, I guess, after all Yehuda's genius and strategy, you still got to kill, you know, five soldiers to every one of you. You're still up against very battle-ready and tried forces. And that's where we're up to now. The wars now are going to continue for another 20 years. The Jews are going to go through this again and again. What happens is every time there's a new leader in Syria, they're going to bring down a new force and try to take the Jews again. What's going to happen is they're going to try to split the Jews, and they try to give them back their, you know, the whole issue is religiously motivated. So they're going to say you can keep your religion, and then they're going to still come back. It's and politically you have to be very, very careful, because in Syria also there's going to, now we're going to have competing forces. So if you back the wrong leader, you're in trouble. And that is where the Jews are now going to have to deal with the new realities on the ground. But at this point now you have Yehuda. He has the country, at least Yerushalayim, the center part of the country, under his control, outside of the fortress. Later is Antonio. And Mr. Shem will pick up. We'll see how the rest of the Hashmonaim dynasty fares.